Well, then we're ready to go. This is Mr. Art Hill. He's a computer guy of many, many years, and he's just going to tell you his story. We're half hour skewed, so we're just going to skew the whole schedule throughout the whole day by half an hour. So anyway, here's Art Hill.
Well, I'm glad to see the faces that I saw yesterday, plus a few more today, and I'd be happy to see more walk in the door any moment. They're not going to miss a great deal, except for things that happened maybe before a lot of them were born. The first question I have in my notes here is, who am I? Okay, who am I? Well, he said, I'm Art Hill. I actually was born January 1922. I'm very happy to be here in my health and my age. But I'm happier because of what the last 50 years has brought to me and my association with the computer world. Very briefly, I graduated from Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Immediately went off to Parris Island. And a few months later, I was commissioned in the Marine Corps. I got to the end of World War II safely. And the Marine Corps said, we don't want you. Go home. Keep your name in the book, you know. Be a reservist, but go home. So I went off to graduate school in New York City, off to Columbia. Got a master's degree in education, and I was going to go out and be a big-time track coach and everything else. That was my field of endeavor, athletically. And I went out to Montana to teach school. If any of you haven't noticed, the boots started when I was teaching school in Montana. I taught in a college in Billings for a year. It's now the Eastern Division of the University of Montana. And I went up into the mountains outside of Yellowstone Park and became the principal of a junior high school when I was 28 years old. I survived there until 1950. The Korean War started. Now the Marine Corps says, back. We'd love to have you. I went back on active duty, and I said, what's the use of this? I love teaching, but out, in, out, break up my life. So I applied for a regular commission, get out of the reserve, and 1951, I got my regular commission, and I stayed for 21 more years. Retired in 1971 as a colonel, United States Marine Corps, and that gave me a lot of flexibility in my life. Because in the Marine Corps, they had chosen me very early to go into the computer program, and nobody even knew what a digital computer was. Or there were a lot of us around that watched the elections in 1952 and saw the UNIVAC make a selection and say that Eisenhower was going to win. They were right. But that was about it. It was a gimmick. It's going to disappear. But the Corps chose to go along with automation, and I was one of the first people to be selected. Why, I'll never... Yes, I do know why. Because I was a food service officer. How do you figure that? I ran an officer's club in Korea and ran the food depot. Well, I figured that because that made me a supply officer. And they were looking for supply officers with certain educational background. But anyway, I was selected and I got into the first computer training class in the Marine Corps. And that was, my selection was in November of 56. And we went to class was supposed to be 6 weeks to learn how to program this digital computer, which we had no idea, except what we'd read in the papers, what this was all about. Turned out it was a file computer, Model 1. There were very few of them ever made. And there was none in existence when we were in the classroom learning how to program it. The second week of programming, after we'd learned a little bit about structures of coding and things, we learned that we had to unlearn everything we'd learned the first 2 weeks because they had reversed the coding, and instead of going this way, it went that way. And our instructor, wonderful guy, some of you older folks might have even met him once or twice in the world. His name was Leo O'Keefe with, at that time, Remington Rand UNIVAC. And Leo, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, every day, would leave the classroom, go to a telephone, call Minneapolis to find out what changes were made since yesterday. And then come back to the classroom and tell us what we had to unlearn and relearn in another direction. It took us almost 6 months to get through that programming class because the machine didn't exist, but we were programming it, and the engineers, the developers, the brains out in the Midwest were telling us what it was going to be like when it finally arrived. Well, be that as it may, my computer life started there. In memory, you know, after 82 years starts to fade. But anyway, somewhere along the way here, having created an inventory control program, which fortunately for me was recognized as being the best in the Department of Defense, and for which I got a large part of the credit, the development, the design, I was sent to Philadelphia to run the program that I had written. Well, that's justice. I had a good team, mostly Marines, but probably 8 or 10 civilians. And just incidentally, lucky me, that's where I met the young lady sitting in the back of the room, is my wife, way back then. She was assigned to the Marine Corps installation in Philadelphia as the support analyst on the UNIVAC file computer. She didn't know any more about it than I did, but she had the benefit of staff to back her up in Philadelphia. And while I was there, I used the benefits of friendship and, you know, many times who you know, not what you do. Well, the benefits of friendship with Grace Marie Hopper. Now, hopefully, most of you at least know the name. Dr. Hopper, who just incidentally sat at the desk next to my wife in Philadelphia in the Remington Rand UNIVAC office before they became Sperry Rand. They were still Remington Rand UNIVAC. And Dr. Hopper had been the head of the the Committee on Data Systems Languages, the CODASIL, that created COBOL. I met Grace because I was the Marine Corps representative to the CODASIL that created COBOL. So I'm all up to here in COBOL, and I'm assigned this new job in Philadelphia, which had nothing to do with COBOL. We had programmed this thing in the specific language of the file computer. And when I got to Philadelphia, I found that I really wasn't doing very well financially. Marines, no military people got paid very much in 1951, 52, 55, 56. Changed a lot today, but nobody got paid much. So I got the urge for a moonlighting job. And because Grace Hopper was there and she knew me from the CODASIL committee in Washington, she made the connections and got me a job with Remington Rand UNIVAC, and I started work in the same building with the same machine where the first original UNIVAC one was created, at Schuylkill Avenue in Philadelphia. Old factory, dirty, run down, but that's where I started. And I was assigned to work in automated computer design, the first, where they used the computer to create its own progeny. And automated computer design, and I'll just reach down and break one of my prized documents, and let's see if this comes up. Is that backwards or is it right? No, that's right. The UNIVAC Prepared Engineering Document Program. And this document, which is an original, shows the program as it was designed, and I was hired to program in the automated computer design department with Remington Rand UNIVAC. And what we were designing was the UNIVAC LARC. LARC, which only two were ever built. See, Salam is not here in his hometown, I guess, Livermore, California. And again, for those who are not familiar, LARC is Livermore Atomic Research Computer, LARC. There were only two ever built, one in Livermore, California, one in David Taylor Model Basin in Washington, D.C., or up the river a little bit from Washington. And I didn't know anything about electronics or engineering or anything else. But the engineers knew what they needed to do to build a machine. They knew what they needed to get connection from here to there, from here to there, wherever it may be. And they specified what the wire size had to be, resistance, concerns about noise, wires crossing each other in the back plane and things. And this program, which I did the coding for, created the backboard wiring tables, originally for the UNIVAC LARC, and then subsequently they used that, probably still do in some sense, to tell the builders, not the designers anymore, the people putting this thing together, here's where you put this piece of wire, here's the size of the wire, and they're all color-coded, here's how long the wire has to be, and here's where the other end goes. And these charts were created, and they're are samples of the charts in the back of this manual, which told the engineers exactly, you know, from where, I'm not going to try to go through the details, but from where, the kind of wire, the length, from terminal here to connection here, and actually became the backplane wiring tables for the UNIVAC LARC. Well, I was thrilled. I was a young major, and this computer world was already had captivated me, and I was able to do this, hard luck, nighttime. I'd leave my office in Philadelphia at 5 o'clock, drive out to the plant, we moved into Bluebell, Pennsylvania, work for 4 hours, drive home in Jersey, try to get some sleep, and back to my office at 7:30 the next morning. But the hard way was wonderful because it gave me such an insight into what could be done with these machines, and it gave me a driven desire to create something for the Marine Corps supply system, which was my primary job, which was unbeatable at that time. Another big benefit, and you'll excuse me if I jump around because memory brings little tricks, but another big benefit to my assignment to design a worldwide inventory control system was, one, the size of the Marine Corps. That helped. But two, I had never been to supply school, so I didn't have to learn or unlearn anything bad. We always joked about the man who was in charge of inventory control in Philadelphia. And what he did that day in the form of filling out requisitions or shipping stuff to the West Coast or wherever, whatever it might be, was based on what time he got up in the morning, how big his belt size was that day, or some unknown numbers in his brain. There was no system to it. And nobody had ever changed anything, probably from the Revolutionary War up to the present. But I had the benefit of not ever having been educated as a supply officer. I went right straight into computers and designing a supply system without knowing anything about what happened before. So they got a system that started from scratch and worked. I won't say the best in the world, but at that time they said it was the best in the world, and we were able to move forward and get something done. That's enough about who I am and where I came from in the computer business. Now, how does it all relate to digital computers other than the fact that that's where we were? We don't have to rehash the history of the guys 200 years ago who made machines with holes in cards that told the machine where to put the warp and the woof and weaving things, Jacquard and his work. That history is all pretty well documented in the books. But there's a lot of stuff that never got into the books and wonders as to where COBOL came from. How many in the room have used COBOL? Pretty good percentage. It's still out there. It's still being used. In 1957, say, I was assigned to the Codicil Committee, and we sat and we listened to this wonderful little old lady. I said she was old. She was younger than I was, but Dr. Hopper had this idea long before the Codicil Committee was formed, and I have piles and piles of documents here. I have her original, I guess it's in the other room, her original Flomatic B2. She and her team wrote Flomatic B2 for the UNIVAC 1 to use English language instead of mathematics or Fortran, formula translators, to create programs. Now, believe it or not, the biggest fighter in this program, opposition, was IBM. They didn't want any part of it. And the reason they joined the effort was because the Department of Defense said, if you don't use COBOL, we don't buy your computers. That's a big leverage stick. But Dr. Hopper's ideas were laughed at. You're going to use English language and tell that machine to do these things? And she proved it with her Flomatic B2, which is a basic English language, which later became the basis of COBOL. Now, because I was involved in that, I found not only great support from the UNIVAC people, because we had a UNIVAC computer, and I had UNIVAC support available to me all the time, but we also found that the people who are designing computers, I don't think we're thinking too hard about what's coming next, because the file computer was designed with a 12-character word with a sign, an internal sign in the word. The UNIVAC 1 had been a 12-character word, but entirely different structure. There was no relationship. They wouldn't communicate with each other at all. And fortunately or unfortunately, as depending on how you look at it, we decided to advance into a new level of computers in the Marine Corps, and we selected Solid State 80. Solid State 80 structure, 10-character word, external sign. And we've got to go from 12-character word, internal sign, to 10-character word, external sign. Same program, without losing any data, without losing any time, without shutting down the entire system for a year while we reprogrammed it. How in the world can you do it? The benefits of knowing the right people and having been there and done that with COBOL immediately came up, and Grace Hopper came to visit us in our installation in Philadelphia. I mean, she was stationed there too, or stationed. She was working there. She wasn't on active duty then. And we discussed the possibility of converting the 12-character internal sign programs to the 10-character external sign programs using COBOL without using or losing any time, any data. Impossible. Gray said, no, it's not impossible. If you follow the rules, we will get the Navy Yard to cooperate. The Navy Yard had a UNIVAC 2 by that time. They had advanced from 1 to 2. And we'll have a compiler running at the Philadelphia Naval Yard, which will take the coding that you do for the file computer, and we'll redo the or do the Solid State 80 with a different structure word and run them through the Navy UNIVAC 2 at the Navy Yard, which is just a couple of miles down the street. And we were or became then the first live application of COBOL anywhere in the world. Flowmatic had been used, of course, at the UNIVAC headquarters and at Bluebell, because Flowmatic was written for the for UNIVAC. In 1960, I'll read it. April 1961, UNIVAC Users Association meeting in Los Angeles, California. The minutes of the meeting. And this is the speech. I'm not sure you can read it up there. Maybe you can. Programming, reprogramming, compatibility in COBOL, Lieutenant Colonel. Oh, I moved up by that time. A.T. Hill. This was the speech that told them what we were doing, and we were, at this time, within 6 weeks of doing the final cutover from one to the other. And everybody at this meeting was excited because we were the first to use the live program to do with COBOL what they said could be done, convert from one structure to another. And that was the reason IBM didn't want COBOL, because it was a great equalizer. They no longer had you by the you-know-what. Because you had an IBM computer with IBM coding and you wanted to change to Honeywell or to UNIVAC or to anybody else, COBOL was a great equalizer. You could now go across, and the program or the complications were basically eliminated. Among the documents of interest, maybe to some here, is RM COBOL Ryan McFarland, which we used basically in the Marine Corps. First edition, COBOL language manual. There are many other things of that nature in this piles of stuff I have out in the other room. Just the quick touch back on something else that happened. We had the file computer. The file computer was basically a tube machine. I believe there were, and somewhere in writing here, 78,000 vacuum tubes in there, our computer center, our computer room in Philadelphia. But the file computer had this wonderful drum memory. The drum did great things for us, and we were able to, well, capitalize on the fact that we had memory available, and we got into cycle times and everything else. And by the way, we were dealing with bits, not bytes, and we programmed with bits, not bytes. We didn't program with bytes and words. We programmed with bits, and the flexibility was unbelievable. But you can't believe, well, I could believe here because I've got the cost in front of me here, but what the cost of memory was in 1957, 58, in that time frame, the cost of memory was so far out of sight that the programmer had to worry about how much memory he used. And so bit programming saved memory. Today, nobody cares about the cost of memory. There's so much memory out there that they're throwing memory to the winds. We had the opportunity to make a change, thanks to UNIVAC's engineering. And this article appeared in the Digest of Marine Corps Supply Activity. Extensive brain surgery. I have a good picture of it. I don't worry about it now. This picture I have, the full size, is the engineer unwrapping the new package that came to us. We took the drum out of the file computer and replaced it with core memory. Core memory? What was that? We didn't know. The engineers told us it was going to do away with so many problems because the drum was gone. We no longer had to worry about latency with a turning drum. And the minimal size, even though the drum itself was relatively large, I say relatively, you know, we're talking probably 18, 20 inch. The core memory in stacks as they are right up here, in the right-hand corner of that picture, come wheeling in, the drum and all of its circuitry goes out the door. The temperature in the room goes down. We had our own 400-volt machine that controlled the power use, and we found out very early in the game that we had to actually be very careful about what we were doing in our computer center at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because two blocks away was the Charms candy factory. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody in there pulled a switch and turned off all the power in the factory. And we were on the same circuit. And engineers would work all night replacing vacuum tubes so we could start up the next morning. So we had to put in a motor generator to completely level out our power situation. Then they put in independent lines because we weren't going to move out of that area for years to come. One of the things that we did with this file computer is we had a pegboard like the old card machines. And we could program portions of the file computer using a pegboard and wiring. At the University of Pennsylvania, they had a group, or related to them, they weren't from the university, but related to the university, they had a group that was doing other wonderful things, and they created very small pegboards, which gave us the ability to program our 600 line a minute printer, so we could get faster output and limit things without writing it in code and putting it in the machine. There's a picture here of one of the guys that designed the machine, or the pegboard, showing me how to replace, just pull a wire out of here and put it in there. That takes care of a couple of lines of code. how much easier that was than rewriting everything every time you wanted to change the position of things. Let me go back to see where I'm jumping out of. I'm sure without fear of people jumping on me here in the room, that very few of you would say you didn't know anything about binary arithmetic. Oh, there's the picture, by the way, the original picture of that. The core memory at the top, the supporting boards from around it. And somebody asked me earlier this morning about the size of the boards in the file computer. These are the boards that supported the core memory installation. To tell you what the size of the other boards was, I would be really straining the poor memory, which is sucking right now. Matter of interest, and this is trivia, we were absolutely blown out of our minds when they told us about the new chips that were going to drive our computer, and they said the chip would go through the eye of a needle. So they presented us with a picture of the chip going through the eye of the needle. Impossible. Nah. Just think of what you have today in your microprocessors. I mean, that's a giant chip. And probably didn't do one-tenth or maybe a thousandth of as much as you do with your current chips today. I wanted to touch on something else here, which goes back into those early days. Get to the right spot. This is my notes say find this, find that. The boxes of stuff that I have out here, finding stuff is most difficult. Oh, the thing I wanted to touch on was the fact that all of us today, we know about the IBM success. The IBM PCs, many of which we may have, some of us have. I don't have one. That's because I swore I would never have one. But there are a lot of people who depended on IBM to give them everything that was ever going to be done with a computer. And some of them still feel that they made out fine. I'm one of those who doesn't believe that. One of the notes that I have here, this is handwritten, but it's a copy from a speech given by a friend of mine. I'm not sure you can read that, can you? Programming is the process through which the will of the manager is supplanted by the intentions of the programmer. Colonel Holmes was a dear friend and did a lot of the design of the nationwide system that we programmed. And he had some very, very good ideas about it. Let's go back again in history a little bit. The first UNIVAC 1. Well, let's go back even before that. Now, Eckert and Mauchly designed the ENIAC and programmed it. And they say in the history books that it was used in World War II. It's not true. It wasn't delivered until after World War II was over. But it ran for many years after that, primarily for calculation of ordnance trajectories. And the ENIAC had, 100,000 or more tubes, and was a problem to maintain, just consumed unbelievable amounts of electricity. But This was done at the University of Pennsylvania. Then Eckert and Mauchly left the University of Pennsylvania, created their own company, and this it was Engineering Research Associates, ERA. And they created the ERA. I'm sorry, back up. Eckert and Mauchly didn't do ERA. Eckert and Mauchly had their own company, created Unibank. Because of many things, most of which were government-oriented, Eckert and Mauchly were driven out of business. The communist scares and investigations of the early 50s or late 40s, believe it or not, had a lot to do with driving them out of business, because they hired lots of bright young people to work in their new company to build Univac. Univac, they thought, had wonderful promise for the business world. And there are some investigators in Washington and our famous congressman who wanted to investigate everybody. I feel like the same thing today, but found that they thought Eckert and Mauchly were hiring communists to write the programs for their new Univac and cut off all government support. Their contracts with the government and everything else were wiped out. Whether or not they had any communists working for them, I don't think anybody ever found out, and it doesn't matter. They had to sell out, and Remington Rand was sitting there with all their office machines and things like that. And Remington Rand saw the possible opportunity here, and they bought Univac. They bought Eckert and Mauchly. At the same time, there was a couple of guys out in Minneapolis. Engineering Research Associates were working on scientific-type computers. And Remington Rand bought out ERA. So they bought out Univac here and ERA here, put them together into Remington Rand Univac, and produced the first Univac, which was delivered to the Census Bureau on March 30th, 1951. Then the first, 1101. Another question, trivia. How many in the room know where the Univac 1101 got its name from? Anybody? I know she does, but anybody know binary coding? 1101. What is it?
13.
It was the 13th model that this engineering research had put together before they were finally satisfied that it was a working machine. And it became the Univac 1101. And that's where the 1100 series started from. The 1101 is the 13th model. After that, of course, it's like Univac 2, 1102, and on up the line they go. I have here among my prized possessions, I'm going to put this up. You probably can't read this either, but I'll point out. Up in the corner is a date of 24 August 1950. Now, I just said the first Univac was delivered in March of 1951 to the Census Bureau. This is in August the previous year, this memorandum saying, for your information, to the Machine Accounting Branch at Headquarters Marine Corps. And the letter with it is from Remington Rand. Didn't even say Univac then. Al Sears, Vice President, Director, General Sales and Services, dated August 17th, 1950. Enclosed was a brochure to the Marine Corps saying, hey, we got the machine for you. They didn't have the machine. The first one was still being built. But they were out there pushing it because they had just bought Eckert and Mauchly's Univac. And they foresaw that this was going to be a big thing. The brochure has wonderful picture. The original machine. Now, this unit in the background is kind of facetious because I walked inside many times. Had to be careful about bumping my head. That's the backside of this picture. The electronic era for business with UNIVAC. And they called it a fact trawler. We never heard that name. A few years later, it disappeared completely. But it was the UNIVAC fact trawler, the first universal electronic system designed for management and science. Oh, pick that up. I guess this is even a better picture of the layout. But what would appear to be a big cabinet in the background was actually, probably as high as this here from the floor. And that's a door through which I walked many times. And the size of this cabinet was, I think probably the size of this stage would be about right, a little bit deeper that way. And a lot of people thought it was air conditioned. It wasn't. It was water cooled. Most of the space inside there was taken up with water pipes pumping cold water through it. And they refrigerated the water to chill it. But air conditioning in 1950 was like, I don't know who had it. The movie theaters advertised air conditioning, but it wasn't what we know as air conditioning today. That huge thing out there in the middle was water cooled, not air conditioned. I won't read all these things. What a businessman should know about UNIVAC, business applications. Is punch card accounting obsolete? The answer, of course, is no, because we had to have cards here too. Now, this will blow your mind if you haven't read it before. Look in the lower right-hand corner. The rate of addition and subtraction, 1,911 digit numbers per second. Wow. I mean, we just didn't believe this stuff at all. They're blowing smoke. Multiplication, 465 11-digit numbers per second. Rate of division, 255. And the rate of comparison, 2,396 numbers per second. I mean, just imagine, this is going to do everything in the world for you for the rest of time. Not just current programs you need. Well, the rest of this brochure is interesting. Who can use it? All of that. Didn't give you any prices. Just asked if you're interested. Please call. And that's 1950, and the Marine Corps finally in 1957 called. Okay, we're interested. And by that time, they had moved on to the file computer, which is the first one we bought, and where I really got my feet wet. Lois told me last night she wondered why I wanted to read this paragraph in the lower left. This is an article written by General Leslie Groves, who was vice president of Remington Rand UNIVAC. Now, Leslie Groves is the man who is given credit, generally speaking, for the development of the atomic bomb in the World War II era. General Leslie Groves, look at this. The actual operation of the UNIVAC system is comparatively simple. A typist punches on the keyboard of a unityper, a device not unlike a typewriter, data and instructions in letters and figures. Unityper records coded characters on reels of magnetic tape in much the same manner as a teletype machine operates. The magnetic tape feeds the information to UNIVAC at a rate of more than 10,000 characters a second. Wow. The computer executes the instructions at electronic speed and records results on magnetic tape. At the same time, it checks its own answer. Now, that was very important. It actually had check bits, and it checked its own answers. Punch cards didn't do that. But anyway, the idea that this was so simple. Just put it in, take it out. Nothing to it. And that was one of the biggest mistakes that anybody ever made, was the idea that this was all going to be so simple at the beginning. Now, this relates to the fact that UNIVAC, Remington Rand UNIVAC, believed that their computers were going to sell in relatively large amounts, I don't say thousands, but they recognized that the Weather Bureau. Dr. Mockley was really interested in developing a machine for the Weather Bureau. Insurance companies, the calculation of everything insurance companies do on probabilities and things, all of this was possible with this machine at great speed. At the same time, up at IBM, we had a nice old man, president probably for many years too long, but his analysis of this UNIVAC machine and what it was going to do was that maybe there would be demand for 10 machines like that in the entire world. Forget it. We're not going to spend all that money. You know, we got all this good punch card stuff. We don't need to create spend the money to build this machine that's going to do everything, because we just won't have any sales for it. Well, he retired. And two big things that happened. UNIVAC, I'm looking for a picture, but I can't find it. UNIVAC blew it. They had the first machine out there. They had the second machine out there. They had probably 30 UNIVACs, including Model 2s, out there in the field in New York Life or Metropolitan Life. I guess it's Metropolitan Life. Anyway, Census Bureau, the Weather Bureau, and they were fast going down the road to build bigger and better stuff before IBM ever started, before the decision was made. We better think about that, and they started out and built the 650. The IBM 701 was the first IBM machine which didn't rely to a large degree on punch cards. The 650 still was punch card oriented. It was a computer, a digital computer, but they were 6 years behind. And in 2 years, it wiped out all the lead, all of the benefits that that UNIVAC had from the start. I've always, I won't say felt bad about that, but because I was there working with them and seeing the advances they made and the automated computer design and things like that, it kind of dug into me a little bit to see the big guys move ahead. And then the Marine Corps decided we had to move up, get out of the file computer, get out of the solid state 80, move on. So we put out a RFP, request for proposal, and put it out to IBM, RCA, NCR, of course UNIVAC. There were five of them.
Honeywell?
Yeah, I think Honeywell. Anyway, we put out an RFP to upgrade our systems. And IBM came back and they said, oh, we got it. 360. It's going to do everything. And, well, it's a along, and to me, a very sad story. But they decided, because I was running the Marine Corps installation in Philadelphia during this inventory control, worldwide inventory control, but they found out that I was moonlighting, writing automated computer design for UNIVAC, and they filed a complaint with the Secretary of the Navy. You know, that I was prejudicing the entire proposal, so I had to resign from my job and get out of the hands-on work that I was so happy with and so excited about. That's another whole story. They continued after me for years and years and years. But I'll just say one thing. Among the memorabilia, which is here in piles, and I'm not going to go through it because we're running. I knew we'd run out of time easily. Is probably the only, and I say that probably because I've never met or heard of anybody else who had it, the only letter of apology from the president of IBM written to me because of what they what their people did in trying to force me to buy their hardware in my job. And it's not framed. It probably should be. I didn't get rich because I didn't sue them. I should have. But that's, you know, a whole third story. The next chapter of this story is going to be when I finally get rid of all of the piles and piles and piles of stuff that I have, most of which is out there on the floor, by the way. And I'm going to settle back with Lois's help. I'm going to write a book, and a lot of this stuff is going to be in my memoirs, assuming I live long enough to get them produced. I'm still going to find this one picture. I refer to after the Marine Corps, after I came home from Vietnam, where, by the way, we had the first computers installed in Vietnam, the first computers installed in trucks. We took an old World War II ordnance vehicle, stuck an IBM 1401 and some punch cards in it, rolled it across the beach in Da Nang, and started running our inventory control with computers in Vietnam at least 2 years before the Air Force and the Army. The Air Force was using transceivers and doing their processing back in Japan or somewhere, maybe in the Philippines. But be that as it may, I finally retired after Vietnam in 1971, and I became the director of data processing for the state of Delaware. Much to my surprise, I found out, well, I knew who arranged it, Dr. Grace Marie Hopper. But how she knew that the state of Delaware was looking for a director, I've never found out. Unfortunately, she's gone. We can't ask her. I've asked her and never got an answer. But she called me. I'm retired. I was in Honolulu, living there, hoping to find a job in Honolulu. Forget that. If I had been Japanese or Chinese, I'd have gotten a job that easy, but I wasn't. That's the most race-oriented state in our union. But I got a phone call in my apartment in Honolulu, and I picked up the phone, and said, "Art, this is Grace." I said, "Oh, wow, where? Are you at the airport? Where are you?" "No, in my office in the Pentagon. Don't talk, just listen." And she was very, very blunt. And she said, "The state of Delaware is looking for you." "What are you talking about?" "Don't talk, just listen." She gives me a phone number and an address, and I guess about 10 days later, I was in Dover interviewing, and about 2 weeks after that, I was in Dover, Delaware, running the state data processing operation. And from Delaware, where unfortunately IBM followed me and tried again to destroy me, but by now I'm a retired Marine colonel, and I don't have to worry about what IBM wants to do. And I blew the whistle on the IBM people who were trying to destroy me, and that's where I got my letter of apology from the president of IBM. I moved on to the state of New Hampshire, right next door up here, and I became the director of data processing in New Hampshire. Up there we had Honeywell machines. I didn't have to deal with IBM. But I got there, and they took my request for the money to cover my move from Delaware to New Hampshire, which was promised to me when they gave me the job. And found out that the governor and council in the state of New Hampshire had voted against paying me anything. And then we found out that at that particular meeting of the governor and council, the local IBM rep was present. Never any relationship, believe me. No. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, George Roberts, in New Hampshire at that time, went to the governor and demanded that he reopen the meeting and exclude the IBM rep, and I got my transfer money. But they followed me everywhere I went for years, and I never forgiven them. Never had an IBM machine in my office. And when my customers, Lois and I, after she retired from Unisys, having gone through all their changes, we ran a point-of-sale installation business, pretty extensive in the Philadelphia area, had a lot of good customers. But whenever I had a customer insist that they wanted IBM equipment in their office, I said, find yourself another analyst. I wouldn't deal with it. Enough about me, about what happened to me. I could talk for 3 days. I've just barely touched on a few things. I've got pictures, I've got slides, I've got stuff out there in boxes. Come by, look at it. Believe me, it's hard on me, and she'll guarantee that that's true. I've been not fighting with her because I can't fight with her for years because I never throw away anything. And now we move from a four-bedroom house with an attic, a garage, and a den into a two-bedroom apartment with nothing. And all of my stuff after I talk to Salam, and thank you. I really thank him because I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't know what to do with a lot of this stuff except for the fact that I was able to communicate with him. I came up here with my car literally to the ceiling, from floor to ceiling, loaded, and I would really like to see this stuff preserved. The hardware, that's non-significant, but the documentation and the books and things, I'll just take another minute. In 1963, just before I went, I have to think of this, 64 maybe, just before I went to Vietnam, I gave a series of lectures at Headquarters Marine Corps, because people still didn't know what these computers were and what they were doing and what they could do for the future of all of us. And all of my lectures were recorded. And I gave my last lecture the day before I left for Vietnam. And while I was in Vietnam, my wife, my first wife, not Lois, but my first wife, transcribed all of my lectures. And there's my 10-lecture course, all typewritten, in a book on the subjects that we've been talking about this morning. So I have an unlimited amount of information, and I just don't want to see it lost. I really don't. And the books and the papers and the pictures and everything else, after listening to Bob yesterday morning, totally convinced somewhere it has to be preserved. And in that light, I'm asking for your help. Thank you.